Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
Governor Andrew Cuomo issued an executive order that took effect this week, requiring every New Yorker out in public to wear masks when it's not possible to practice social distancing. Meanwhile, while the governor says the virus continues to claim hundreds and hundreds of lives every day, the rate of hospitalizations may have already peaked. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The governor says the order requires that all New Yorkers, when out in public, wear masks or scarves or bandanas that cover their nose and mouth when it's not possible to practice social distancing.
You're walking down the street. You're walking down the street alone. Great. You're now at an intersection, and there are people in the intersection, and you're going to be in proximity to other people. Put the mask on. Your right to go out for a walk in the park, go out for a walk because you need to get out of the house, the dog is getting on your nerves, fine. Don't infect me. You don't have a right to infect me.
He says for now there will be no civil penalties or fines for not wearing a mask, but he'll consider doing so if people don't comply. Cuomo also delivered some good news about the coronavirus Wednesday, saying that the rate of hospitalizations may be past the apex and on the decline, with 18,335 New Yorkers in the hospital on Tuesday. But he says the death toll at 752 on April 14th may be even higher, as the state will now be counting probable deaths from COVID-19. New York City began using the new CDC guidelines to include in their count those who may have died from the virus but did not go to a hospital. That put the city's death toll from the pandemic at over 10,000 people. Cuomo says the state will now be going back and recounting to include those who likely died from the coronavirus but did not go to a hospital or were unable to get a test. Cuomo says while he is eager to restart the economy, no one should expect that things will go back to the way they were before the pandemic. He says it will be a gradual reopening with many safety precautions. The governor says criteria will include how essential the business is and how high risk that business is for spreading of infection. He says companies can make adjustments to make their workplaces safer when they're allowed to reopen.
Some businesses can say, I can open tomorrow. In my business, I'll have all sorts of precautions. People will not be less than 6 feet apart, period. There will be no congregation of people. I won't do conferences. I won't do joint meetings. It's not the way my business operates. I can bring everybody back, put them at separate desks. They'll never be near each other. I have a very low risk of infection spread. Businesses can start to redesign their workplace to think that way.
But Cuomo says even a phased reopening won't be safe without more testing and contact tracing. He says there are lots of obstacles, including not enough testing equipment like swabs and vials. He says test kits are made by private companies and involve an international supply chain. The governor says only the federal government can bring testing to scale. The states can't do it on their own, and he urged the Trump administration to act. In the meantime, New York is seeking FDA approval for a finger prick test for antibodies. It could test up to 100,000 people a day. The governor says it will be prioritized for healthcare workers. But Cuomo says nothing will be truly safe until there's a vaccine, and that won't be for 12 to 18 months. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. The governor of New York working constantly on the coronavirus, of course, his daily briefings. He must have done, I don't know, close to 40 programs by the time we're speaking this week to keep updating people, including trying to keep the situation between New York and the federal government, specifically his relationship with the president, clear of politics and trying to take him on. Well, not taking him on, I guess. This week, he's ordered all people to wear face coverings in public. He had some positive news, the leveling off and even a dip in hospitalizations. However, the deaths are tragic and the numbers are shocking. And we're way far from the end of this thing.
We are, David, and Cuomo has been remarkable. One day, just one day, I saw him do 8 appearances on MSNBC, on CNN. And for some wonderful reason, he likes to spend a little bit of time each week with us here in public radio, and we've had some remarkable conversations. You know, it can't be easy for this guy. You know, he has a father who he loved and who is so important to him, and who I had the pleasure and the privilege of talking to over many, many years. And so he asked, what would Barrio do in that kind of a situation? Obviously, he has a brother who has it and is getting quite depressed, clearly, about the whole thing. And his wife has now gotten it, Chris's wife, and he feels very badly about that. So he has it on a personal level. He has it on a political level. And yet he leads. He leads scientifically. He does what he's supposed to be doing. As opposed to a president who knows his reelection is going to be predicated on getting back to work, getting the economy started, even if it's a very dangerous move. And that places a guy like Cuomo in some real political danger. Sure, it's political. There's no question it's political. If one guy says, open the economy and put people at risk, and the other guy says, it's too early to do that, what we have is a classic study, as we've always mentioned, the authoritative allocation of scarce resources, meaning the moment you move the chess piece, you have made a political move. And Cuomo has to worry because he's dependent on the president to do for New York. And at the same time, when the president says something outrageous, it demands that he do something about it.
Yeah, and the governor, you know, in the morning one day this week, after the president claimed he had ultimate authority to tell the states what to do, did a little lesson in the Constitution and saying, you know, he's not a king and that's not how it works here in America. And then by the afternoon said, you know, I'm not getting into the political fray. I'm not going to fight this guy. I have to work with him.
Well, that's right. And I think that's exactly right. On the one hand, he had the guts to say what needed to be said. And then, you know, who knows who he, whether he talked to the White House or what happened or whether they threatened him. But in any case, he toned it down and he said, I have to work with him. And that's exactly the truth.
Interesting conversation on your Capital Connection program this week with Senator Julia Salazar, Democrat from the Working Families Party, Brooklyn. She was pretty clear about a couple of things. One, that Governor Cuomo has been doing a fabulous job in terms of handling the crisis, but that when it comes to the money involved, where are you going to get it from? And she says, tax the ultra rich. They should pay their fair share in this because the poor will get hurt more.
Well, Salazar, a remarkable young woman, the youngest woman ever elected to the New York State Senate, is a progressive in the same mode as AOC, the famous AOC, is in the Congress. She is representative of basically those young people who are Bernieites, who are saying we've got to move forward and we've got to have a more equitable distribution of income and everything else in the United States. Nevertheless, she is one of the few, as opposed to the vast majority of people who are looking for a centrist position. So she's well worth listening to, that's for sure. On the other hand, it ain't there yet.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartoff. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Following the signing of the third coronavirus stimulus package at the end of March, New York Congressman Antonio Delgado is turning his attention to what's being called COVID-4. Delgado has been focusing on small businesses and family farms in his 19th district and also rural broadband. This week, he spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
House Democrats say they were able to include $150 billion to support state and local governments in the third bipartisan COVID-19 emergency relief package. Still, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo criticized the bill for not helping the state enough. Delgado, a fellow Democrat, says the next bill needs to continue to build resources for state and local entities.
The cost of, protecting our community, the cost of saving lives, the cost of protecting our economy, all of these things, are a real issue. And it is important that we continue to build on that. I'll say, and it's important to note this, that when we were negotiating the CARES Act the first go around, the opposing side of the aisle did not want to do anything for state and local entities. And so we were able to secure the funds that we were, which ultimately would be divided amongst the state and local governments, but only because Democrats really, pushed that, fairly aggressively. So the work continues in that space, and it should continue in that space. And I've, talked to my colleagues in the New York delegation. I signed on to a letter that makes it clear that we want to make sure that moving forward, the unique situation of New York is accounted for. We are the canary in the mine in many respects for the country. And so it's important that, as we allocate resources, it reflects that unique situation we find ourselves in. I'd also note that, we want to continue to build out those pieces that we need to build out to ensure the economy can bounce back. And that means making sure we're thinking about infrastructure. It means making sure we're thinking about investment in, broadband access. We know how important those things are right now for our communities, from homeschooling to small businesses being able to switch their, their platforms online to telemedicine. So it's so critical that we get broadband up and running. And then we've got to work out the kinks that in the CARES Act.
Meantime, Governor Cuomo recently issued an executive order allowing the state to redistribute ventilators and personal protective equipment from institutions that don't currently need them and redeploy the equipment to other hospitals with the highest need. The order softens the governor's previous stance of mandating that ventilators and such from upstate hospitals be sent to New York City, a stance met with concern by Delgado and others on both sides of the aisle.
To me, and some of the reporting on that was very sloppy. In my opinion, when you hear publications trying to describe a point of view as condemnation, to me that's the kind of reporting that is an indictment on some of the elements in journalism, present company excluded. What we were doing, what I was doing, was just simply expressing the point in making the observation that, while we are certainly always willing and ready to stand with our fellow New Yorkers in any situation, any endeavor, as somebody who represents the upstate community, as somebody who's seen firsthand the shortages, in terms of healthcare access, in terms of personnel, in terms of equipment, that have plagued our area well before the pandemic, it was just a matter of expressing that reality and making it clear that, we think about all these dynamics while we seek to make sure that we're there for each other in every way, shape, or form possible during this critical time. And it's just unfortunate, in my opinion, that some folks saw it as an opportunity to drive wedges and politicize the situation.
Can I just ask for comment on how the order did come out, which I believe says make sure your needs are met first, wherever you are upstate, before anything.
Well, that's the point, right? The point is, we look out for everybody, we look out for each other, and we make sure that everybody's needs across the board are accounted for. Because everybody right now is going through it. People are really hurting all throughout this state, we want to make sure that as we shift things around, as we move things. We're doing so in a way that accounts for the realities on the ground, wherever they may be.
And which this seems to do. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that.
New York Congressman Antonio Delgado represents the 19th District.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette. a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. During the coronavirus pandemic, healthcare workers have been on the front lines, pulling long shifts in often dangerous conditions. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has one nurse's story.
Jennifer Bejo has been an intensive care unit nurse at Albany Medical Center for 13 years.
As a nurse, I cannot stay home. We're still going to work to care for patients that are front lines, trying to prevent death and slow the spread of COVID-19. However, no matter how strong we are not invincible. Right now, you know, I'm one of those nurses who are very concerned that the response to the COVID-19 pandemic from federal, state, and local authorities and many healthcare facilities is not adequate. We already saw or have seen the evidence from all over the state that many hospitals are failing to adequately protect frontline healthcare workers. Right now, I worked, open up like, you know, our COVID, you know, ICU units, and I'm one of those nurses who's taking care of these very critical patients from all over the region and even from New York City.
When it comes to PPE, personal protective equipment, Bejo says there's not enough.
You know, we always felt that we were sent to war without enough ammunition. So, you know, the lack of PPEs, you know, created more panic in this stressful situation. There's a shortage of masks. You know, the provision of this essential equipment is so inadequate that we have to sterilize and reuse N95s. And, you know, we all know that reusing it is not safe at all. It's a breach of infection control protocols, and even the manufacturer's instruction say that it should not be reused. And it's also concerning to note that even the nurses on the floor that are not directly involved in caring for COVID patients are being reprimanded for wearing the regular mask. So, you know, like all of us, nurses feel that we are not protected at all.
Bejo says frontline caregivers should be given a voice when it comes to protecting themselves and their patients.
I think we should be calling on our representatives in Congress to make sure any COVID legislation includes health and safety protections for healthcare workers. We also want OSHA to issue an emergency temporary standard to ensure healthcare facilities implement comprehensive infectious disease exposure control plans. I believe that President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act in order to produce equipment that frontline health workers need to battle the pandemic, but he hasn't unleashed its full power to jumpstart production on PPE that we so desperately need. We don't need N95 respirators 8 months or several months from now. We already needed them yesterday.
Bejo says COVID-19 patients, many of them critical, often die alone since visitors are prohibited.
You know, it poses a risk of contamination, people coming from outside and coming in. We don't know whether they're, even though they don't exhibit like any symptoms, they can be carriers. That's the scary part of it. I believe that the community and everybody should understand that the COVID virus is 30 times deadlier than H1N1, than flu. And as we've seen, you know, like deaths, like, you know, everywhere, social distancing is only one way of flattening the curve and containing the infection.
Bejo believes all nurses should be tested.
We don't get to be tested, like, you know, until we became symptomatic or we show, like, symptoms of respiratory, like, you know, problems. So healthcare workers who are exposed must be tested so they don't put their colleagues, patients, and families and even community at risk.
What would you say to people who say, you're a nurse, isn't this what you signed up for?
I agree that this is what I signed up for as a professional nurse. However, I did not sign up being pushed in a battle without any protective gear. I did not sign up for taking my life at risk as well as, you know, risking my family's health, risking the patients that I care for, risking the life or of the patients that I care for. I believe that I signed up for this with the expectations that administrators in the hospital are also there to support and protect me as much as I protect the patients that I care for and the communities that I care for.
When her ICU shift is over and Beho goes home, there is no off-duty when dealing with COVID-19.
I'm always scared that I may be carrying the virus, like, you know, to my house and infecting my son, infecting my husband, putting their lives more at risk than mine. I do not have that privilege to send my family away or to, like, find myself, like, you know, somewhere to stay until this COVID, like, you know, crisis is done. You know, like, social distancing is still continuous in inside my house. It's hard for me to not be able to, like, hug or get too close to my son without being fearful that I may get him sick. I wear a mask at home.
Beho was among other nurses who gathered outside Albany Med on Saturday. In these days when she and her colleagues are being praised for their work, she says they appreciate public support.
One thing is for sure, that the human spirit and the will to survive can withstand any crisis or disaster or misfortune. We have gotten, like, you know, the community support, and it's so astounding and very heartwarming.
Albany Med has issued a statement that says, in part, "The safety and protection of our workforce and our patients remain Albany Med's top priorities. We continue to follow guidelines established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the New York State Department of Health regarding proper use of personal protective equipment. Albany Med has adequate supplies of masks and other PPE. There's more at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Every year, the Cary Institute for Global Good in rural Albany County serves as a refuge for journalists and documentarians from around the globe through its Logan Nonfiction Program. Its latest residencies wrapped up in March just before the pandemic took hold. Fellows there have been tackling subjects ranging from climate change to the U.S. prison system. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King filed this report.
Filmmaker Zara Katz and investigative reporter Lisa Reardon-Seville are working on the in-progress documentary Women on the Outside. They've been observing the U.S. prison system for a long time. Starting with the collaborative Instagram feed Everyday Incarceration in 2014, the pair amassed a nearly 40-year archive of photography centered on inmates in prisons throughout the country. Reardon-Seville says that's how their newest project was born.
One piece of the puzzle that was really missing was the way in which women support loved ones inside and the rippling effect of incarceration. And so we spoke to women across the country about their experience of supporting a loved one and then ended up connecting with a number of them, including Crystal Bush, who at the time was running a van service called Bridging the Gap. She picked up women around Philadelphia and drove them to visit their loved ones in prison.
Crystal Bush of Philadelphia ended up becoming the main focus of Women on the Outside. When Katz and Reardon-Seville met Bush 4 years ago, she was 27 and had seen nearly all the men in her life locked up, including her father, brother, ex-boyfriend, and several cousins. And Bush's experience wasn't necessarily uncommon in her urban, mostly black neighborhood. In 2015, the New York Times estimated more than 30,000 black men between the ages of 25 and 54 were missing from everyday life in the city, with many behind bars. Driving hours across the state as Bridging the Gap was her way of not only supporting others in her position, but of making ends meet. Reardon-Seville says caring for a loved one in prison is more expensive than you might think.
For many years, phone calls were extremely expensive, so people were paying a lot of money to keep in touch with their loved ones. They put money on their commissary for their loved ones to eat and buy underwear and buy socks and buy deodorant and buy toothpaste, and that could amount to anything between $20 to several hundred dollars a month, depending on how much you had to give and how many people in prison you were supporting. The trips are very long, and they can be hundreds of miles to go visit someone, which means a day off work. And then, you know, people talk about the difficulty of walking out the door and leaving their loved one behind.
Reardon Seville says Bush's father and brother were both released from prison shortly after they started filming, with almost 40 collective years behind bars. Other documentaries have depicted the obstacles faced by parolees upon reentry. Many struggle to find jobs, make ends meet, and avoid breaking the strict rules of their parole. The subject is also increasingly relevant. New York became the latest state to eliminate cash bail for most nonviolent offenses earlier this year, a move that has since received its fair share of backlash. Pennsylvania hasn't followed suit on the legislative level, but Philadelphia's courts recently agreed to small changes that could result in more people being released pre-trial. Lately, in an effort to decongest prisons during the coronavirus pandemic, the state moved to temporarily release potentially thousands of nonviolent offenders. While this wasn't the specific case in Bush's family, Reardon Seville and Katz say inmates still rely on the women in their lives once they get out of prison, and the complexities of that experience are typically overlooked.
Crystal, for instance, you know, she grew up in the time that her father was in prison. She was a small child when he went away, and, you know, she's an adult. She owns a home, she has a job, she has a business, and so figuring out how to balance that can be really challenging, and again, stigmatized, because the last thing you want to say is, I'm tired of helping.
Yeah. With our film, you see that Crystal is helping her father pay rent. She finds an apartment for him while he's even still in, but, you know, hopeful with a release date that she's paying rent for an apartment for several months. She actually became the guardian of her brother's son while he was still incarcerated, because there was a potential of the son going into foster care. And then when her brother came home, really hopeful that they would build a relationship, but it just wasn't a reality that his father was going to be able to take him full time. So then actually moving forward for a full adoption, even though she doesn't have any kids of her own, she became a parent because of prison.
Katz says both Bush's father and brother ended up violating their parole and returning to prison. Their stay at the Cary Institute involved hours in the campus basement, editing rooms, stitching the story together clip by clip. Women on the Outside does not yet have a release date, but you can learn more about the project at WAMC.org. Reporting from Rensselaerville, I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2016. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino.